Good morning, Sinead Egan here with Playback.
Oh, I'm heartbroken. It's honestly just, it destroyed me last night. It was horrible.
Were you a big One Direction fan?
I was, yeah. I went to see them in 2013 and it was my first ever concert. So yeah, it's a bit heartbreaking.
Radio 1 reporter Maura Fay in Dundalk getting reaction on Thursday morning to the news that One Direction member and pop superstar Liam Payne had died after falling off a balcony in Buenos Aires. He was just 31 years old.
It's really shocking, honestly. I saw it early in the morning today and I didn't believe it at first, but yeah, like, I've been a fan of him for years. I've been a fan of One Direction since the start, so it is honestly really shocking.
Oh, so shocking. Like, we're a similar age and that alone, like, was just devastating to hear. Like, he's so much ahead of him, like, so much opportunity, and now his son as well, like, and God love him, God love the family as well, like, so.
From growing up, like, knowing him, like, just big fans and all, it's just sad. Yeah. It's heartbreaking to hear.
It's so sad.
Oh, absolutely devastated. I used to love him when I was growing up. He was my idol, like, everything to me when I was growing up, so, yeah, it was all, I was devastated when I found out.
You know, I was in an absolute shock. Shed a tear, like, you know, because I loved him, like, do you know what I mean? Lots of hard times listening to him, but, you know, he helped me get through that. Getting emotional just thinking about it, you know?
One Direction fans on Thursday mornings today with Claire Byrne. And you might remember that Liam Payne first appeared on The X Factor when he was a very young teenager. He was unsuccessful the first time round at 14, but things went better for him 2 years later.
Liam. How are you?
How are you doing, Simon? You're all right.
Nice to see you.
I haven't seen you in a long time.
It's been a while. 2 years, yeah?
2 years, yeah, 2 years. And now you say you're lonely. You cried the whole night through. Simon?
Yes?
This is the guy you didn't put through.
He wasn't quite ready when he came to my house 2 years ago, but I said to him then, come back 2 years' time and you're going to be a different person. I've got to tell you, Liam, you're 16, right?
Uh-huh, 16.
Right, that was extraordinary.
Before I was on the show, I was actually doing, I was singing, I was doing gigs and stuff up and down the country, just like really, really small gigs. Like, I mean, I travelled like 2 hours to play to 10 people in a field when there's meant to be like 200 people there, like crazy stuff like that.
I called my dad, I was like, this is weird, I know, I just told you I'm out, but they want to put me in a boy band. Like, what do you think about it? He said, well, you can either be 100% of nothing or 1/5 of something. And I thought, very clever, Jeffrey.
And the something that he went on to become 1/5 of was, of course, One Direction. Liam Payne was open with his fans about his mental health struggles and his alcohol addiction. Fellow X Factor contestant Mary Byrne shared her memories of Liam with Claire Byrne on Thursday's Today Show.
This is a shock that I found when I heard this last night, was that, you know, Liam always gave me the impression that he was the one that had his head on his shoulders, and that he was the one that kind of guided the rest of the lads and got them up and motivated them to do the job. And to think that this young man now, at 31 years of age, has gone down a road that's so dark and you know, couldn't come back for some reason, it's heartbreaking.
It is. And so you were saying that the Liam that you knew was a bit of an old soul.
He was. And you know, when I heard the news, I remember the first thing that came into my mind was his face. He had this blonde hair with locks, I remember that, and this little face, but he had an old head on his shoulders. I remember talking to him about business, and we were talking about when they make it big and that, and I said, Liam, keep your dad, he'd be very close to his father, and I said, keep your dad beside you all the time. And he said, look, me and my dad are going into business together, and we're talking about going into property and all, putting the money into property. So he had a good outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after that, God only knows, but look, it's life, and especially in that business, when you become that big in such a short time, you know, you need to have the people around you who are going to hold you and keep you grounded and keep your mind straight. And obviously, somewhere along the line, that all stopped for Liam.
Singer Mary Byrne on Thursday. Well, another man who knew a thing or two about pop superstardom was David Bowie. He was an artist whose creative instinct was to always look forward and embrace the new. In fact, he was the first rock star to see the full potential of the internet as a way to release music and as a way to interact with his fans. Or at least it seems that way. In his documentary Hello Space Boy, David Coughlan tells the story of Dara O'Carney, a Bowie superfan who for many years had an email correspondence with a person who signed their messages DB. But was it the man himself?
He was fascinated by culture. He was a big admirer of Beckett. He used to recommend a lot of books as well. He was a voracious reader. So it mostly became us just talking about books and TV and movies that we were both interested in. Now, I still didn't really think it was David Bowie that I was dealing with, but I thought maybe it's actually somebody in his circle, because it's certainly somebody who's smart enough never to send me an email when he's on concert or something like that. It was always believable that it was at least somebody in his time zone.
Dara says the emails continued regularly when he was in his mid-30s and Bowie was in his mid-50s. But Dara never asked DB outright if it was the real David Bowie.
Oh, I never asked him at any point. I'm not sure why. I guess I thought there was just no point, because if it was an imitator, that's what they want you to do. Then they've kind of won the game. Now they've put the thought in your mind and you finally do ask.
But then in 2003, an opportunity to figure out if Dara really was communicating with Major Tom. David Bowie played some gigs in Dublin and DB offered to put Dara on the guest list.
So I arrived at the point well ahead of the concert and went up to the security and said, I think I might be on the guest list. And they looked at me very suspiciously, like, is there even a guest list?
For Dara, the guest list was not just about entry to the sold-out show. It was a chance to solve his pen pal mystery.
And then one of them went away and he came back with a single sheet of paper and he was like, what's your name? And I gave him my name. I could see there was only about three or four names on the list. And he goes, OK, yeah, you're here, you plus one. This is ground control
to Major Tom. You've really made... Dara still wasn't sure. Then he remembered an email exchange with DB from earlier that very day. One where he had suggested, out of mischief, that the singer say an Irish phrase on stage that night. A phrase more commonly associated with the Irish Republican cause.
Purely as a joke, I said, just say Chucky or Law. And he was like, okay, how do you say that? How do you pronounce that? So I wrote it out, C-H-U-C-K-Y, whatever.
Dara says his pen pal was well aware of the bloody history of the phrase, which means our day will come.
Oh, he knew. He knew. No, I think he ran it by a few other people as well.
Jerry Leonard remembers talking to Bowie backstage before the gig, unaware of any emails.
He asked me for some Irish phrases when we did those concerts in the Point. And I was like, well, you know, you could say, you know, Conestatu or some nice things. And then I said, you could also say Chucky or Lore, you know, and he loved that.
In front of an audience of whatever, and there's a lot of English fans, a lot of everything. At the end of Rebel Rebel, he shouts, Chucky or Lore!
That clinched it for Dara. He now believed his pen pal was David Bowie all along.
That was kind of the moment in my mind. I said, OK, this is definitely him I'm talking to now.
From David Coughlan's documentary, Hello Space Boy. And if you want to hear the whole thing, check out the Doc on One on the RTE radio player or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, to be fair, David Bowie never had the monopoly on being sound to his fans. I'm thinking of a certain Donegal man. Here's Mary Ellen on Tuesday's Ray D'Arcy show.
Granny was a big fan, Mummy's a big fan, and also my two girls, Kira and Mia, they're sort of following on the family tradition.
Right, so it's four generations.
Yeah, four generations, big Daniel fans.
That's spectacular. And you are big on TikTok. Will you tell our listeners what you do on the first of every month?
Well, it's a bit of a family tradition, Ray, so it is in the O'Hare family. Every month we make a bit of a thing out of turning over the calendar and just to reveal what new outfit our lovely Daniel is wearing for that month. And it just cheers us up on the first of every month. We get a big roar and it sets us up for a good month ahead.
Yeah. We just have the revealing, I suppose that's the word, isn't it? The reveal, the big reveal for October.
The big reveal.
So this is you from TikTok. We'll just play the audio here just to give people an idea. So this is the big reveal for TikTok.
Here we go. Oh, I am excited. Let's see what October has in store. Oh, Daniel. Oh,
Yes. There you go. And just to describe, I think it's denim on denim. From what I can see here, it's a denim shirt, denim trousers. Yeah. And then he has a sports coat draped over his right shoulder, and he's looking very suave. Yeah. Very, very, very suave.
Very, 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 very sassy and classy is our Daniel. Yeah.
Well, so far, 1.2 million people have watched the October double denim reveal on TikTok, and we can only dream of what's in store for November. Or actually, we could probably ask someone who might know. Now, brace yourselves.
Oh. Hello there. How are you?
Daniel!
I think I know that squeal.
Oh, Daniel!
Oh dear, well do you know what I was thinking, Ray? And I was thinking maybe I should bring out a weekly show. There'd be 52 weeks.
I think you should bring a daily one out, Daniel.
Oh dear. Well, you made me smile too. I just saw it last week.
Yeah, would you have enough outfits, Daniel?
I don't know now. I'd have to go back to the wardrobe again to see what's lying about.
Yeah. So, Mary Ellen, what would you like to say to Daniel now that you have him?
Keep up the good work, Daniel. Yeah. Keep up the good work you make.
Now people are waiting to see what way it's going to be every month. I can't even remember what I'm wearing in November. So I would need to take a peek too.
Think of the calendar sales next year, Daniel. Let's go through the roof.
I think your father might be checking to see, am I suitably attired? That I wouldn't be coming out with nothing on some month.
No.
The always dapper Daniel O'Donnell on Tuesday's Ray D'Arcy Show. On the live line this week, the perils of travelling with a less than perfect passport. Anne told Jo about what happened with her sister when they were on their way to Italy.
I was standing beside my sister and she took out her passport. I said, God, what's that sticker on my passport? You know the way it's sometimes little sticker. So she opened it and the two of us just looked and said, Jesus Christ, when we saw the passport. She had mother's passport.
Mammy's passport.
Now, mother's passport. Now, fortunately, the passport was in date.
Yes.
And she was had the same Christian name as my mother.
Okay.
So.
And where was Mammy in date? Where was your mother?
In heaven.
Oh. She got an earlier flight.
She had.
Oh, the poor. How long had your mother been passed at that stage?
She was probably dead about a year.
Okay,
and my sister was in the house one day. And she said, oh, isn't that a beautiful photo of mother in the passport? I'm bringing this with me. Okay. So she brought it home to her own house.
Yeah.
And it was probably just left somewhere.
Yes,
and then it got thrown into the drawer with the other passports in the house. And sure, like, there shouldn't be any other passport in her
drawer. So what did you do? I'm dying to know, Anne. What did you do? Was your mother looking down on you?
She certainly was.
Okay.
So we proceeded. I said, just put your name on your finger on the date of birth. You say.
What was the age difference? What was the age difference?
30 years.
A good story well told on Liveline. Now, how about some more lateral thinking, courtesy of the business?
I read recently where we have 11 million senses and 10 million of them senses are visual. So if your head is stuck in the book, you might just be missing everything around you.
Sean Brett is the founder of Steel Tech Sheds.
Sitting in the class and having absolutely no idea what was going on. I could read, but very, very slowly. I get the words mixed up. You'd be sitting in terror in case the teacher would ask you to read from a page in a book. Then the other classmates start laughing at you. So it was horrendous. I'm sure dyslexia people knew what it was 50 years ago, but if they did, they didn't know in County Mayo, unfortunately. It's a few years ago, and the lad said, we have a problem in the showroom in Cork. Somebody broke in at the weekend and stole two of our sheds. I said, lads, it's not a problem, it's an opportunity. And like, they couldn't see it. But in a second, I could see the opportunity was that we're going to promote this on social media and we'll get the sympathy vote from all the people in Cork. So we did that. We picked up an extra 20,000 followers. And then eventually some guy, we offered a reward of €1,000. And some guy rang us up and told us exactly where the two sheds were. Not alone did we get the two sheds back, but when the Gardaí called, they got a whole load of stolen equipment.
Sean Brett of Steel Tech Sheds there. She from Mulqueen also spoke to visual artist Tara Kearns.
I'll always remember the rule when it comes to an F word becoming plural. I still can hear the teacher saying, what does elf turn into? Elves, one student said. She got to me and we were sitting there sweating and stressing out. And she's like, now, what does calves turn into? And we were like, a cow. And she was like, suppose you're not wrong, fair enough. You had to be like thinking outside the box to try to get around the fact to hide that you can't spell so you wouldn't get in trouble. My name is Tara Kearns. I'm a visual artist from Sheriff Street and I'm one of many artists that have dyslexia. It is very frustrating when you're trying to say something and you're trying to write it down and you know what you're trying to say but you just can't get the words out. I can communicate, I just have to do it in a different way. Like if I was good at writing, I probably wouldn't be good at painting. Like, I mean, I'll take not being able to spell because I'm really happy that I can do this amazing thing where I can pour my heart out onto a canvas and I can have someone else look at that and completely understand within 2 seconds what I was trying to say. That is amazing to me and I love it. And it's why you keep doing what you're doing. It's almost addictive.
Artist Tara Kearns in Schieffer Mulqueen's report on the business.
Playback on RTE Radio 1. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer.
You're listening to Playback with me, Sinead Egan. Sinn Féin under pressure was the political story of the week.
A party press officer accused of child sex offences given job references by party officials. A senator who resigned after sending inappropriate messages to a minor. One TD who resigns after claiming she was silenced. And another who resigns after claiming he had been subjected to a kangaroo court.
But let's rewind just a bit. Leash Offaly TD Brian Stanley departed from Sinn Féin on Saturday, saying he'd been subjected to a flawed inquiry process. This inquiry was into a complaint made about him. Deputy Stanley said the process resembled a kangaroo court. A counter-allegation was made and the internal Sinn Féin process was suspended with the matter passed to Gardaí. Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald spoke to Mary Wilson on Monday's Morning Ireland.
Firstly, although I would prefer to be on your programme, as you can well imagine, talking to you about housing and health and childcare and all of the things that matter to society. However, as the leader of Sinn Féin, when complaints are made, when there is a question of behaviour, when are the standards within the party, I make no apology to anybody for insisting that the rules are applied fairly, without fear, without favour. And secondly, the referral to An Garda the Síochána was made in an abundance of caution because I was not happy, nor would I be happy, with the party left with a serious complaint and a serious counter allegation. And I want that matter, and it's a process left in suspension.
Mary Wilson had questions about leadership.
You're the party leader. The buck stops with you. Here you are, the one trying to explain and defend this morning, and yet you didn't know what was going on. Surely that begs the question, are you in charge of this party at all?
Well, Mary, I am very much in charge of this party. And as the person with whom the buck does stop, I am absolutely insistent that rules and procedures are applied rigorously.
Well, did they fail you then? Did the rules procedures fail you?
That the procedures are far from it, that they are followed rigorously and impartially. And then the buck does stop with me. And sorry, let me finish. Mm-hmm. When matters were brought to my attention and when I was fully briefed on Saturday night, I absolutely stand over the decision to refer matters for an abundance of caution onward to An Garda the Síochána. And can I suggest to you, Mary, had I not done that, you would very fairly, in this interview this morning, put that question to me. You would ask me why not. And that would be a fair question. And aren't there...
On Tuesday, Mary Lou MacDonald addressed the Dáil on the several controversies surrounding her party, including the separate matter of the full circumstances surrounding the departure of former Senator Niall O'Donnell, who resigned from the Shannon and from Sinn Féin last year. On Tuesday, it was revealed that he had sent inappropriate text messages to two individuals, including a 17-year-old male.
The question may be asked and has been asked legitimately,
as to why Sinn Féin didn't inform the Oireachtas of the circumstances of Niall O'Donnell's resignation as a senator. And that's a fair question, and let me answer it. In the summer of 2021, Niall O'Donnell was on extended leave from his duties in the Shannon due to very serious mental health issues. Following the complaint, we were advised that Niall O'Donnell was again suffering from a mental health crisis and was deemed medically unfit for work by his doctor. As Cian Corlea, we were very worried that publicly naming him would be dangerous to his health. And that is not to make an excuse for his behaviour, but we had very serious concerns for his mental health and his safety. And I still hold some of those concerns to this very day. Niall O'Donnell publicly resigned on December 21st last. And on that occasion, I wished him and his family well. I acknowledged his work in the past. And above all, I wished him well in dealing with his very, very significant health challenges.
On Wednesday, Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty spoke to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland.
Do you accept that Sinn Féin misled the Oireachtas and the public about the reason for his resigning from the Shannon?
I think that, you know, people will judge ourselves. I heard Padraig McLaughlin, who's our chief whip, who was at that meeting, speaking to RTÉ yesterday, who was at that meeting, who described to the public that he was sitting in front of a person who was in severe crisis. And that is not in any way to absolve Niall O'Donnell from what he did.
But the Oireachtas was told he was resigning from the Shannon for ill health. That wasn't the full reason that he was resigning from the Oireachtas.
First of all, let's be clear, we can't force any member or any non-member of the party, and Niall would have been not a member of the party at that stage because he had resigned, and he told us he was resigning from...
Yes, but his resignation announcement was issued through a Sinn Féin press release, even though he wasn't a member of Sinn Féin anymore.
But we can't force anybody to resign from the Dáil or the Shannon, as we see in terms of Brian Stanley's case, that is the case.
No, but you can be honest about why he's resigning from the Shannon.
Well, as I outlined to you and as Mary Lou outlined in the floor of the Dáil yesterday, this was a decision that was taken in the context of somebody who was going through a profound mental health crisis.
Yes, you've said that, and Mary Lou has said that, but do you accept that decision had the result of misleading the Oireachtas and the public?
I accept that the full information was not provided, but I also accept that people now know why that full information was not provided. It is important to state that Niall O'Donnell faced all of the rigours of the party in relation to he lost his job, he lost his position within the party, and he was referred for a criminal investigation to the PSNI and social services. So Sinn Féin carried out this in relation to the processes in terms of child protection to the letter, and indeed we were commended by the PSNI in relation to the fact that the victim in this stated that they were content with how Sinn Féin handled this issue.
Political correspondent Paul Cunningham gave Rachel English this analysis of the status of the storm surrounding Sinn Féin on Wednesday's News at One.
I think from Sinn Féin's point of view, they feel that basically they've drawn a line under this particular one regarding the former senator. They say processes were followed, the PSNI and social services were informed, and then it was the judgment of Mary Lou MacDonald that on the senator's departure, they didn't mention inappropriate messages on the basis of concerns due to his mental health. She made that call. Other parties like Fine Gael suggest it was a particularly bad call and the Oireachtas was kept in the dark in order to protect Sinn Féin rather than anyone else. But I think ultimately, voters are going to have to decide on that one. I don't see too much new information coming into the public domain.
Can we move on then, Paul, to Brian Stanley? Mary Lou MacDonald said that in his case, the complainant was traumatised. And in response, Mr. Stanley accused her of abusing Doyle privilege. Is there now pressure on him to make a statement to the Doyle himself?
Fine Gael certainly believes that there is an onus on him to do just that. Government sources said earlier on this morning that that should happen. Then the former Minister for Justice, Fine Gael's Charlie Flanagan, said it needed to happen on X. Labour, though, interestingly, is not backing that call. Ivana Bacic said she had concerns regarding the privacy of the complainant in the first instance. And she also said the second factor was that there was an absence of information about what the complaint involves, and therefore it's not possible to determine whether the floor of the Dáil is the right and proper place for this to be considered.
So
where does all of this then, Paul, where does it go from here? Because while Brian Stanley has issued, I think, three statements at this stage, we haven't really heard from him, despite the fact that no doubt every journalist in the country has asked to speak to him.
Well, that's it. I think that if it is the case that Brian Stanley chooses not to make a Doyle statement, the other opportunity is to make an interview. And in both cases, he signalled that isn't his intention. I think you have to put some weight on this issue in which he said that matters were before the Gardaí. That seemed to indicate, although I haven't spoken to him directly, that seemed to indicate it, that that's where he felt this issue was heading. It was up to the Gardaí to make a determination in relation to matters that he'd raised.
Paul Cunningham there. Etty Higgins is UNICEF's deputy representative in Lebanon, and on Monday she described the reality for displaced children in the region facing intense Israeli attacks. She told Claire Byrne about areas where schools have ceased to be places of learning and instead have become makeshift places of shelter.
The impression that we got from speaking to so many of the communities and to the children themselves was they just wanted to go back home and they just wanted a normal routine and they wanted the bombings to stop. That was the big things that they asked for. So really fear of anything from airplanes passing overhead to doors banging, any loud noises, really very, 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 very difficult. And when we spoke to the mothers as well, they told us about the difficulties in getting food, especially for the children under the age of two, how they struggle to just keep their children occupied during the day. They're all crammed into these classrooms. So it is really a very, very, very difficult and very tense situation.
Mm. Etty, you described their fears there, the fears of the doors banging, the planes flying overhead. Some of these children have become separated from their parents, which is a dreadful situation. But for others, there's a great fear of that happening for them.
Indeed. Some of the children that we spoke to asked us to make bracelets and to make sure that they had their names on the bracelets with the phone number and contact details of their parents or their caregivers. And they asked us this both in the shelters, but also when we visited the border with Syria yesterday, they asked us the same thing because of the crowds. Often they get evacuation orders to move from certain areas that are going to be hit by airstrikes or by shelling. And they told us that they didn't want to be separated from their families, or that if they were killed, that they wanted their remains to be identified. And this is completely unacceptable for children to have to think about, to even think or consider these things.
UNICEF Deputy Representative in Lebanon, Etty Higgins, speaking with Claire Byrne. On Friday's Morning Ireland, Channel 4's Porrick O'Brien had detail of the Israeli army strike in Rafah that killed Yahya Sinwar, a Hamas mastermind of the October 7th attacks.
I'm in Haifa in Israel, which is near the Lebanese border. And we're here because five Israeli soldiers were killed here on Wednesday, several injured brought to the hospital that I'm standing outside. And we were here yesterday also when these photographs of Sinwar's body started popping up on the phones of the soldiers that we were speaking to. The pictures show this mangled corpse. This is one of the chief architects, remember, of the October the 7th attack, and he was his body dead in the rubble. The pictures we saw were taken by the Israeli soldiers who killed him in Rafah, that's in the south of Gaza, and they show Sinwar with a large open wound to the head. He's wearing military fatigues, fitting, some would say, for the man who planned the attack, you know, that brought the Middle East to the edge of all-out war.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, said afterwards, "The mission ahead of us is still unfinished." Could this be a turning point? Will this be a turning point?
I doubt it. I think that Netanyahu's stated aims when it comes to this war were to bring down Hamas, both politically and militarily, and crucially, to bring back the remaining hostages. Remember, about 101 hostages still inside Gaza. It's assumed that about half of them are alive. But in Israel, where I am, that's what everyone is talking about. What's going to happen to those remaining hostages inside Gaza? There is a fear, speaking to the families of some of the hostages remained, that the captors of their loved ones inside Gaza may panic at news of the death of Sinwar and that there would be some, you know, terrible outcome as a result of that. But the political energy here in Israel is beginning already to focus on those hostages. In terms of Netanyahu, though, some interesting polling out today in the Israeli media, putting him at around 24% ahead of Benny Gantz, the leader of the opposition, at around 20. So, you know, to a certain extent, at the moment at least, Netanyahu is one of the winners here. It seems that this is kind of cementing support from him, although, of course, all that could change.
Pádraic O'Brien from Channel 4 News speaking there to Áine Lawler. Well, Donald Trump was a hot topic on Arena when Sean Rocks chatted with the stars of the controversial new film, The Apprentice, which has stoked the anger of the presidential candidate. In the film, Succession's Jeremy Strong plays the notorious lawyer Roy Cohen, who guided the early career of Donald Trump. He's played in the film by actor of the moment, Sebastian Stan.
It's very clear to me that Donald Trump has always been attracted to power. And that has to come from a really deep, 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 deep place of and some emotional need to overcome a great feeling of powerlessness that at some point he must have experienced in a very, very traumatic way. He's certainly not taking time to think about that. And instead, he's playing out his demons on the rest of everybody else that comes across his way. What does the loss of the self and therefore of humanity due to a person and right? And how dangerous is that?
That is the question, I suppose, ultimately, that the movie asks, because we, as people living in the free world, we hope, might just pay the price for something like that, Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think, you know, Trump posted about the film at 1 a.m. this morning. And I guess my feeling is, if he found this film so threatening, it must be because he recognized some truths in it that he doesn't want the world to see. If he found it so threatening as to call us all human scum, which is a term that I find very troubling, because it's a phrase that Stalin used, that Hitler used, that Kim Jong uses, that Bolsonaro used. You know, it's scary, scary language, and it's right out of Roy Cohn's playbook, but it does kind of bring us, you know, this is a film. We're artists, we're actors doing our, you know, practicing an art form to tell a story, full stop. But it happens to be at this intersection of history and politics in a very real way, and, you know, we're sort of in the line of fire now, for better or worse, but I do think the film has something to offer the world.
Actor Jeremy Strong speaking with Sean Rocks about his new film, The Apprentice, on Monday's Arena. The renowned tenor Paul Byram was Sarah McInerney's guest on Wednesday's Drive Time. He told her about his experience of tracing his birth mother and uncovering along the way the series of lies that were told to his adoptive family and to his birth mother.
When I started this process, I was expecting just to get the medical records. And then when I literally got a 2-page document sent to me in the outset, and I saw St. Patrick's Home, Dublin, and I thought, that doesn't sound like a private nursing home. Of course, you Google St. Patrick's Home and you realise very quickly I was born into a mother's and baby's home. So I was hit by a bus. You know, it was quite traumatic at that point, because I all I was thinking was like, well, what was my up? I just assumed that was other people. That was, you know, the likes of Christine Buckley, who told the stories, you know, many, many moons ago. And I just assumed that was that time, that era, and that was nothing to do with me. And so then it became a matter of urgency for me to find my birth mother, because I wanted to know she was okay. I needed to know that she was okay. But more importantly, I wanted her to know I was okay. And my mother, Kathleen, was very much the driving force in me to go find my birth mother.
So, and that was a question I had. What led you to make that decision that you wanted to go find her?
I think every time I kind of, when I turned 30, I'd give it a thought. I'd go, I wonder, does she think of me? And then when I turned 40, I was like, I wonder, is she thinking of me? You know, is she still around or what? You know, I didn't know anything about her. And I suppose I was beginning to feel a little bit guilty that I knew she was powerless in finding me, that it had to be from me. And I think I just wanted to let her know she had nothing to feel guilty about. I needed her to know that I had a lovely upbringing. I was very loved. and that she had nothing to feel guilty about, and that I was very grateful to her, and I still am to this day. And I know both of them are listening today, and they're both wonderful women, and I've just been blessed.
Paul described meeting his birth mother for the first time.
It was lovely. It was very odd. Obviously, initially, you're kind of, you don't know what you're walking into or who you're walking into, or and she was lovely and charming from the get-go, and we hit it off straight away. But it was emotional, and it was emotional for her, I think, as well. You know, I think I resembled certain family members that she had, and we've kept in touch throughout. We've become friends, and I did say to her from the get-go, look, you know, I'm delighted to meet you, but, you know, Kathleen will always be mom. Mm. And she actually says, if anything ever changes, I'll kick you in the arse. You know, she was the same, and she was very grateful, and to my mom, and she was very open, and she was like, look, you know, the life I wanted you to have, you got. So we were lucky, and it ended up well.
How did she react when she realised that your mom had been sending her photos that she'd never got?
It was very upsetting. And she then turned around and she said, I'm assuming you got the orange doggy I left in your cot. And I said, no. So she left a little orange doggy and she said, just make sure he has that. And I never got it. It was taken from me, and as I said, the photos never got to her. It was very cold, very callous. And look, you know, you could be angry, you can be bitter. I suppose I'm frustrated more than anything. But I think both my mom, Kathleen, and my birth mother are angry, you know, very angry at the way they were lied to. And I suppose, look, I think you hear so many bad endings to these stories. And I suppose I wanted to primarily come on to say to anybody that's out there that's kind of contemplating or maybe a little disillusioned or maybe browbeaten by this process to not give up, because there's lovely resolution in it, and it can often be very rewarding. It can obviously often be upsetting and not maybe the result that you want, but yeah, there is good stories as well.
The tenor Paul Byrom on Drive Time with Sarah McInerney. Well, Joseph's Hair Salon on Glasheen Road in Cork will close at the end of the year. The salon has been on the go since 1985. Owner Joe Byrne spoke to Rachel English about his decision to close and about the work the salon has done, giving free haircuts in the community over the years.
So what we do, we open the salon certain times of the year and we have huge fundraising, but like, you know, Easter selection boxes, all sorts of things. We work with domestic violence and penny dinners. We look after mums. We look after kids for communions. We try to cheer them up with a wash, cut and blow dry. We try to cheer up a homeless person with a wash, cut and blow dry. It's not just a wash, cut and blow dry. It's normally the physical contact, the chat, the bonding with someone.
And tell us about that experience, because, you know, if somebody comes into you and they're homeless or they have particular financial difficulties, what do you say to them?
Well, first of all, the first thing I say, this is not a charity. I'm not the big I am doing something amazing, because to you guys are amazing to be surviving them, the problems you have in life. So what I do is just do the hair, chat. You know, hairdressers always listen to the problems anywhere. I'm like a psychiatrist, unpaid psychiatrist, obviously, Rachel. But like, they tell me their stories, they tell me their addiction, they tell me their mental state, they tell me their physical abuse, they tell me the state of their kids. And to tell me how hard it's made to ends meet. And these are not just homeless people. These are people that are already being a home and things like that, but still struggling. But, you know, to do a homeless man and he to start crying while you're shampooing his hair, and not because he's getting food and stuff, it's because he's having contact with somebody.
Joe Byrne, the owner of Joseph's Hair Salon, with Rachel English on the News at 1.
Playback on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. On Thursday's Today Show, Claire Byrne spoke to mother and son Lucy and Tony Barry. Tony's life changed completely this time last year when he was diagnosed with a brain tumour. It was discovered after he collapsed while he was out running. His mother Lucy described witnessing the kinds of medical conversations that every parent dreads.
He's inside with the oncologist, and the oncologist is taking him through what's ahead of him and how it's going to happen and how everything is going to proceed. And she's been awfully nice and very professional. But Tony, being Tony, wanted some black and white answers. So he starts asking her about the elephant in the room, which is, am I going to die from this? How long do I have? Am I going to die before my friends? What's it going to look like? And I'm sitting in the chair and I'm a 67-year-old woman listening to my son, who's 36, asking these questions. And there's something very unnatural about that. You know, if it was the other way around, it would be more natural. But I think perhaps that was my lowest point. I found that extremely harrowing.
Yeah, very difficult. And that's the type of person you are, Tony. You want to hear it straight, do you?
Oh, yeah. I'm black and white and don't do grey areas. So just give it to me between the eyes. You know,
What were you told when you asked those questions?
Well, what I was told is, I suppose, initially that my tumour is slow growing and that it was benign. And it's a tumour is called an astrocytoma. So it's a low grade 2. So I was just told what the treatment would be and that I should make a full recovery after the surgery.
Well, Tony's still going through treatment, but he'll be returning to work next month. And as Claire learned, despite everything, and even in the most challenging of moments, Tony still managed to prioritise romance.
Did you set up a Tinder date in the hospital?
Yes, that is true.
You're not getting away with not telling us about this.
God, great researchers. So the night before surgery, I was in hospital by myself. My parents had just left. So I was just swiping on Tinder just for the crack more so than anything because I was bored out of my head.
Yeah.
And so matched with this girl anyway and explained the situation. So she travelled over to the hospital and we basically walked around the hospital for about 2 hours just chatting.
That night?
The night before surgery.
Right.
Yeah.
What a way to spend the time.
But it
didn't go anywhere, did it?
No, lovely girl, but no, it didn't.
I don't think there was a second date.
No, there wasn't. No, I hadn't time. I was too busy getting surgery.
Listen, around Christmas now, you know, it's a good time. So,
yeah.
And you'll be back on your feet and you'll be back in work. So back on Tinder.
Back.
He is back on Tinder.
No, I'm not back. I'm not back yet. Maybe soon though. Who knows?
Tony and Lucy Barry with Claire Byrne on Thursday. And sure, while we're on the topic of romance, here's poet Paul Durkin, who turned 80 this week.
When I was a boy, myself and my girl used bicycle up to the Phoenix Park. Outside the gates, we used to lie in the grass, making love outside Horus and Uchtaroin. Often I wondered what De Valera would have thought inside in his ivory tower, if he knew that we were in his green, green grass, making love outside Horus on Uchtaroin. Because the odd thing was, oh, how odd it was, we both revered Irish patriots, and we dreamed our dreams of a green, green flag, making love outside Horus and Uchtaroin. But even had our names been Diarmaid and Gráinne, we doubted De Valera's approval. For a poet's son and a judge's daughter, making love outside Horus and Uchtaroin. I see him now in the heat haze of the day, blindly stalking us down, and levelling an ancient rifle, he says, stop making love outside Horus on Uchtaroin.
A recording there of Paul Durkin reading his poem Making Love Outside Horus on Uchtaroin, as heard on Thursday night's Arena. A collection of his poems, 80 at 80, has just been published to mark the poet's birthday. Sean Rocks discussed his work with poet Paula Meehan and writer Colm Tobin.
You would hear him on the radio in those years. I think for anyone listening would remember just the extraordinary mixture of comic timing and a sort of dead seriousness and earnestness. And the fact that the most outrageous image could emerge, closeted in some other further sort of statement that would be sometimes very simple and sometimes unusual, in that his mind was always working towards something that was not... He wasn't interested in surrealism, but he managed to be serious without ever being solemn.
And Paula, you've spoken about this idea, which I love, that it's not an audience that Paul Durkin had or has at a reading. It's a congregation.
Yeah, I mean, he's the great artist of the transformation in the moment of performance. And you would actually be sitting on the edge of your chair And, you know, he's great at poking the audience as well, mm-hmm. Both in the text and in the performances. So you know that you're part of his bigger spell. And he does have devotees, like especially, you know, in the heyday, the 80s, the 90s, where he was out on the road a lot. Mm. And you'd go along and, like, I mean, people were rapt. And even the people he's poking at, like especially the Dublin middle class, mm-hmm. they're lapping it up. They're loving every minute of it.
From Thursday's arena, Paula Meehan and Colm Tobin on the work of Paul Durkin, who just turned 80. Now, we had All Creatures Great and Small on RTE Radio 1 this week, as Brendan O'Connor came to air on Saturday.
First, by the way, I'm just going to tell you where things are at for me, OK? There's a small fly circling around me, and if you hear a bang or anything, if I see him, I'm going to have to get him. I'll try not to get up and chase him around the room with a newspaper, which is what I want to do. But if you do hear a bang or anything, that's me getting the fly. Anyway.
Well, Brendan persevered bravely, as did Ray Darcy on Monday.
Now, it's not every day that we have a cat in studio, let alone the winner of the Best in Show of the Governing Council of the Cat Fancy of Ireland's Supreme Cat Show. Forest Side Lenny is a Siberian kitten who won the show yesterday. And Forest Side Lenny, can I call him Lenny? Yeah, Lenny is here with his owner, Elaine McManus. Congratulations, Elaine. Congratulations, Lenny.
Thanks very much for having us, Ray.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So this is your first cat show, his first cat show?
Yeah. Our first show.
Yeah,
we're still in shock that we won.
Yes. And he's gone off rambling there.
Yeah.
He's going up behind the RT sign there in Studio 6.
A cat with a surname, I kid you not. Well, on Countrywide, the clue is in the name for Lurg, a 3-year-old golden retriever with a very important job. He sniffs out mink, which are an invasive species and detrimental to bird populations. Lorna Siggins met Lurg and his owner, Owen Murphy, on Loch Ree, and they put him through his paces.
Okay, so stay.
I am now going to go over to an oak on Ferrers Island, and Lurg and Owen will not have known where I've put this file of mink scent. Right, just in there, and placing the vial with the mink scent, which I can't smell, but I'm hoping that Lurg will.
I generally task him or get him ready that he's now searching, but I say the word mink.
He's under a tree.
When he stares like that.
Oh, he's staring.
Yeah,
That's a
behaviour he doesn't exhibit anywhere else. So that's
right.
That's called the indication.
Okay.
You're training that into him and he'll stay there.
So it's a really intense stare.
Yeah.
Oh, good boy. Good boy. Yeah. He only took 2 minutes to find that.
I mean, their noses are incredibly powerful. Good fun at work, isn't it? Maybe he might want to go on for a bit of a swim.
Ah, Lurg is just the best boy. He earned that swim from Countrywide. Well, don't forget that you can listen back to all the items and interviews featured on today's show via the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay tuned for Richard Kern with The Business coming up shortly on RTE Radio 1. But from me, until the next time, bye-bye and thanks for listening.